Hello again. I'm Kathleen Dunn. You are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Monday, the 13th of June. With all the conversation about voting and voting rights and voter ID in Wisconsin and in other states, it got us thinking about the history of voting in the United States, and we're going to do a couple shows, one on voter ID down the road. But today we thought we would look at the Voting Rights Act of 1965. And welcome your phone calls. On August 6th of 1965, President Johnson signed the voting rights legislation, which closely followed the language of the 15th Amendment, applied a nationwide prohibition against the denial or abridgment of the right to vote on the literacy tests on a nationwide basis. It also contained special enforcement provisions targeted at those areas of the country where Congress believed the potential for discrimination to be the greatest. This, of course, was a long and bloody fight. On Tuesday, August 3rd, the House of Representatives passed the Voting Rights Conference Report, 328-74, a bomb threat the next day altered Dr. Martin Luther King's departing flight for 8 speech appearances in Washington, during which the U.S. Senate passed the identical bill, 72-18, to sweep aside the last parliamentary obstacles along with the dominant political reality since the end of Reconstruction. Our guest this hour knows this battle firsthand. He is distinguished professor and scholar at the Pacific McGeorge School of Law. He has 22 years of experience working in the U.S. Department of Justice Civil Rights Division, and as a trial attorney was associate counsel in the Selma, Alabama civil rights cases. We're going to be welcoming phone calls for Professor Brian Landsberg. Here is our phone number, 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. 8655. Our email is talk@wpr.org. Professor Brian Landsberg, thank you very much for being with us.
My pleasure.
Tell me more about your involvement as associate counsel in the Selma, Alabama civil rights cases. What kinds of cases were you involved with, sir?
Well, those were voting rights cases primarily, also public accommodations discrimination cases. In the 1950s and 60s, the Selma, Dallas County, which is of which Selma is the county seat, had a board of registrars that systematically denied blacks the right to vote. And then when they started being very insistent on the right to vote in the mid-1960s, 62, 63, 64, the sheriff and the local judges of Selma were really violent in their approach toward the African Americans who were trying to register to vote. And that became the focal point of the voting rights movement in Alabama.
So the Voting Rights Act that we saw signed into law in August of 65 was the result of court cases that had taken place well before that, or just in the years immediately previous to 65?
Well, the government couldn't bring voting cases until 1957, when the first Civil Rights Act, the first modern Civil Rights Act, was passed. Mm. Interestingly, in the 1800s, after the Civil War, after the 15th Amendment was enacted in 1870, guaranteeing the right to vote, there were a lot of African-American voters in Alabama, but through violence by the Ku Klux Klan and when the Reconstruction ended, basically, and the Northern troops were withdrawn from Alabama, they pretty much all lost the right to vote. And so then there was a modern revival of voting rights in the 1950s, and so the first suits in Dallas County were brought in the early 1960s, though.
Mm-hmm. You know, when we say those years, I am just still dumbfounded by the fact that it wasn't that long ago that this law was passed in this country. So many years after the Civil War.
Well, that's right. Basically, it was the Voting Rights Act was passed 95 years after the 15th Amendment theoretically guaranteed the right to vote to African Americans, but it wasn't until the Voting Rights Act was passed that that promise became a reality. And so then after 1965, the battleground shifted toward the enforcement of the Voting Rights Act. And one of the first cases involving enforcement occurred in Dallas County, because in the first election after passage of the Voting Rights Act in Alabama, there was a big move to replace the sheriff. Sheriff Jim Clark, and African Americans played a big role in that. On election night, the Dallas County Democratic Committee, which was administering the Democratic primary, impounded all of the ballots from the primarily African American precincts. And they were going to throw out those ballots, in which case Sheriff Clark would win again.
Hmm.
And so that triggered another lawsuit to make sure that the votes were actually counted. So before the Voting Rights Act was passed, the big issue was, can you get registered to vote? After the Voting Rights Act, the issue was, now that you're registered, will your votes really count?
Both of which are extremely important. Can you, were there certain incidences that really raised the certain acts of violence or murder that gave this issue national prominence, and it needed national prominence for there to be a voter ID bill?
Not a voter ID bill, but a voting rights bill.
I mean, a voter rights. I'm thinking of Wisconsin. Voting rights.
Yes, of course, the one that's probably most burned into people's memories is the killing of the three civil rights workers in Mississippi in 1964 during what was called the Mississippi Summer, organized by civil rights groups. And those were people who were trying to organize the African-American community in Philadelphia, Mississippi, Neshoba County, to register to vote. And then in 1965, during registration efforts in Dallas County and a neighboring county called Perry County, there was an incident where an African-American named Jimmy Lee Jackson was shot to death by a state trooper. And that shooting led to the march from Selma to Montgomery. And so the African Americans organized this march from Selma to Montgomery. They were met after they crossed the bridge from Selma over the Alabama River on the way to Montgomery. They were met by state troopers again,
mm-hmm.
and who told them to stop. And there was sort of a face-off, and then the state troopers who were mounted on horses, and also sheriff's deputies mounted on horses, fired tear gas at the marchers and charged them and beat them very brutally. This time, there were television cameras recording the scene, and that evening, there was a showing of a movie on ABC television called Judgment at Nuremberg about the Nazi war crime trial. And they interrupted that program to show live footage, or not live, but to show footage of what had happened at the Edmund Pettus Bridge, the charge of the state troopers on the marchers. And that led to enormous outrage throughout the country, and the President Johnson immediately announced that he was going to propose a Voting Rights Act.
And yet it was met with so much resistance, particularly among Southern legislators. Why?
Well, this, of course, the Southern legislators, their elections depended upon there being a white electorate. They were representing the whites, and they were not representing the African Americans. They knew that if this law were to pass, and if African Americans got the vote, it would make a sea change in the composition of elected officers, from the city councils to the state legislatures to the Congress, and that, of course, has in fact happened.
Mm-hmm. And the bill was filibustered.
The bill was filibustered. There were very, very strong debates on it, but there was a bipartisan coalition that supported it very strongly, and there was a lot of course, bargaining about the details of the bill, but the bill eventually passed and became law in August of 1965.
Mm-hmm. And if you would please detail, however deeply you would like to, the prevailing discriminatory practices in the early 1960s.
Sure. Well, the first one was that in order to register to vote, you had to fill out a form, and it was not the simple kind of form that just asked for your name and so on. Sorry, are you there?
Yes, we're here.
It was a form that asked a lot of questions, and if you made a mistake on any of the questions, then you would not be registered to vote if you were black. If you were white, often the registrars would help you fill out the form, or else they would ignore mistakes that were made. So the first device that was used to stop blacks from voting, from registering to vote, was to apply different standards to them when they were trying to register to vote. And that was coupled with literacy requirements. And in some states, people were required to read and interpret provisions of the state constitution or the federal constitution, which, of course, even the Supreme Court has trouble interpreting sometimes. One of the more bizarre devices was used in Louisiana. They required you to state your age in years, months, and days, and it's very complicated to try to do that. You don't know whether you're supposed to count the first day, count the last day, and how ludicrous this was shown when in one of our cases, our lawyer examining one of the registrars asked her to calculate her age in years, months, and days, and she couldn't do it. So again, African Americans were disqualified for not being able to do it. Whites would be registered even if they got it wrong. Another device was the requirement that you supply a supporting witness to vouch for your qualifications as a voter. And since almost all of the voters were white, it made it very difficult to find a supporting witness. In fact, in some counties, they would not allow African Americans to serve as supporting witnesses, even if they were registered to vote. And so under the 1957 Act, what would happen is that the courts would, after the government had brought suit and had proved its case, they would order the registrars to stop their discriminatory practices. And then the registrars would simply adopt some new practice. They would adopt a new test. They would adopt waiting periods for registering to vote. They would have slowdowns. So you'd have hundreds of people lined up outside the courthouse to register, and they would only process maybe 8 or 10 people over the course of a full day.
Oh, my.
There was even in Perry County, the registrars would move from office to office so that the African-Americans couldn't find them when they wanted to register to vote. Somehow the white people could find them because the people in the courthouse would tell them where to go. So there was a variety of practices used. And then on top of that, there was violence and intimidation. So I interviewed a school teacher, for example, who had tried to register to vote, and even though she was a teacher, she was deemed not qualified to vote. And I wanted to use her as a witness in our case. And she said, "You can't use me as a witness. If you do, I'm going to lose my job."
Mm.
The matter of fact, the first voting rights cases brought after the 1957 Act were brought in Tennessee when sharecroppers in Haywood County, Tennessee, were evicted from their farms because they tried to register to vote. So it was a system of both official and unofficial actions that stood in the way of African-American voting. The one final one that I would mention is the poll tax.
Yes, please. I was going to ask you that.
So the poll tax was a tax that poll tax means a head tax. And it's a very obsolete tax, but in the southern states, they retained the poll tax, but you didn't really have to pay it. But you wouldn't be able to vote unless you paid it. And one of the devices that was used to make the poll tax even more onerous was to make it cumulative. So let's say you hadn't paid your poll tax for 10 years, and then you decided you wanted to try to register to vote. You couldn't register to vote, or you couldn't vote until you had paid back all of the back poll taxes. So it's called the cumulative poll tax. The poll tax was made unconstitutional in federal elections by a constitutional amendment in the 1960s. But it didn't apply to state elections. So the Voting Rights Act actually directed the Attorney General to bring suit against the use of the poll tax in state elections, which we did, and the Supreme Court finally held that those were unconstitutional.
We're going to welcome phone calls. We're looking at we're doing several shows on the history of voting in this country. This one is the Voting Rights Act of 1965. Our guest is Professor Brian Landsberg, distinguished professor and scholar at Pacific McGeorge School of Law. He, as a trial attorney, was an associate counsel in the Selma, Alabama civil rights cases, worked with the U.S. Department of Justice Civil Rights Division for some 22 years. Here is our phone number, 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Our email address, if you'd like to use that, is talk@wpr.org, talk@wpr.org. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We go to your phone calls now, starting with Bill in Madison. Hi, Bill.
Hello. Depending on what side of the political divide you lie, you either say this following is either an article of faith or it's blatantly untrue. Back in 2000, it was widely reported that the Florida State Police, at the orders of Governor Jeb Bush, brother of the future president, ordered the State Patrol to set up roadblocks, trees falling across the road, detours, various kinds of devices to misdirect or outright block, you know, voters in Democratic-leaning, especially African-American rural districts, you know, to prevent them, you know, as a voter suppression method to keep them from voting. Was there ever any real evidence uncovered that this activity took place? And I'll take your comment off the air.
I'm not really aware of that. It, certainly activities such as that would be a violation of the Voting Rights Act. And the Act focuses quite a bit on the voting process itself. It allows the Department of Justice to send observers into the polling places. If there were allegations of that sort of thing, certainly they would have been investigated by the Civil Rights Division, or should have been investigated by the Civil Rights Division, because it would be a blatant violation of the Act.
Thanks, Bill, for the call. From what I've read about congressional deliberations and the filibuster, there were many in Congress who wanted to hold fast to the poll tax, that was something that was debated and debated and debated. Why did they want to do so?
Well, I guess the reasons that they were giving, number one, were constitutional reasons. They said that the Supreme Court had upheld the poll tax in two prior decisions, and then because the poll tax had been outlawed only in federal elections, that implied that it was lawful in state elections. So I think one reason, the official reason that was given, was a legal reason. I think that underlying it, however, it was the fact that the poll tax genuinely was an impediment toward the vote. You know, the amount of money for the poll tax was something like $2. So it doesn't sound like a lot of money to us. But we're talking about a very impoverished population to whom
yes.
$2 would have meant could have meant a meal. So it was a sizable expenditure for them. If it's a family, a husband and wife, that doubles the amount. And if you do it over a period of years, it becomes simply more money than some people could afford.
Mm-hmm.
And those people, and it hit especially hard on African Americans, because that was the group that was the most impoverished in the Deep South.
We go next to Kurt in Chippewa Falls. Hi, Kurt.
Good morning. I see some subtle similarities between the situation that the guest is talking about and our debate in Wisconsin over photo identification for voting, in terms of the general impediment to and restriction of voters to actually vote. Specifically, is the guest aware of were the impediments to voting in the South ever justified in terms of preventing fraud and abuse of the vote, such as the reason being given here in Wisconsin to justify photo identification?
I think that the justifications were more crude than that. The fraud and abuse that they were suggested, that was being suggested, was that African Americans are not competent to exercise an intelligent vote, and therefore they will be taken advantage of by unscrupulous politicians, or people will buy their votes. Those kinds of arguments were quite prevalent. Not that there would be fraud. Now, there was actually a federal prosecution for fraud in the 1980s, I think, of an African American, Albert Turner, who had been one of the heroes of the Selma Montgomery March. He had been helping people vote absentee, and elderly people especially who couldn't make it to the polls. And he was accused in federal court of basically acting fraudulently and just casting the vote the way he wanted rather than the way that they wanted. That case was tried by a U.S. attorney named Jeffrey Sessions. And a jury in Mobile, Alabama, acquitted Albert Turner and his wife, Evelyn, from these charges. And Jeff Sessions, of course, now sits in the U.S. Senate and is one of the people who has been very opposed to the Voting Rights Act continuously.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that's interesting.
Isn't it?
Yeah. Thank you very much, Kurt, for your call.
Thank you.
When you were involved as a trial attorney with these cases in Selma, Alabama, did you feel like you got a fair shake from the courts, or was there a lot of shady business?
There was. It depended on which judge we were appearing before. In my book, Free at Last to Vote, I talk about three cases. One, and each case was before a different judge. One judge was quite hostile toward civil rights cases, and we assumed in every case that we would lose the case and have to take it to the Court of Appeal. So we were essentially trying the case as though we had to convince the Court of Appeals. Another judge was Judge Frank M. Johnson, who was one of the fairest, most impressive judges I've ever had any contact with. He was a wonderful judge, and he got very angry, actually, in the case I write about, the Elmore County case. The registrar had burned the voting registration records, and then was trying to use that as a defense to the case. And Judge Johnson was quite angry at him for doing that and ruled against him. And then there was a judge who I think tried to act fairly, but was troubled by going against the prevailing winds of the white elite. So he did rule in our favor, but he issued relief that was very weak.
Hmm.
So it was all over the lot.
Mm-hmm. Do you remember what that relief was?
Well, it was just a general injunction, don't discriminate.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, the law already said you couldn't discriminate. We had asked that the people the African-Americans whom we had proved had been the victims of discrimination should be registered forthwith, right away. And he was unwilling to issue that kind of relief.
We go next to Steve in Colfax. Hi, Steve.
Good morning. Say, at the top of your program, you mentioned the interruption of the broadcast of a judgment at Nuremberg by footage of the Selma police brutality. And I just wanted to make a quick point that the judgment at Nuremberg was, the Nuremberg trials were most represented by a gentleman named Telford Taylor as the U.S. Attorney, the prosecuting attorney. And this guy, individually, this was during McCarthy, with our very own Wisconsin Joe McCarthy raising mayhem at the Capitol. He stood up to him, and we're in need of people like that these days. I'm enjoying your program. Thank you.
Thank you. Thanks very much for the call.
Yeah, we are. I might just mention that the other person who was in charge of the prosecution was Justice Robert Jackson of the Supreme Court, who later on joined the unanimous decision of the court in Brown versus Board of Education.
Hmm.
And I think that his thinking about the race issue was very strongly influenced by what he saw when he went to Germany to try the Nuremberg cases.
Our phone number is 800-486-8655. We're talking about the history of the Voting Rights Act of 1965. This hour of the program with Brian Landsberg, distinguished professor and scholar at Pacific McGeorge School of Law. Professor Landsberg, tell me about how you got involved in all of this. How did you happen to work for the Civil Rights Division of the U.S. Department of Justice? How did you happen to become a counsel in those civil rights cases in Selma?
Well, it was a matter of great luck and fortune on my part. I really wanted, when I was in law school at the University of California at Berkeley, I was very interested in civil rights law, but there wasn't very much civil rights law then. The 1957 Act had just passed, and the Civil Rights Division was very, very small. It happened that John Doerr, who was one of the leaders of the division, was a graduate of my law school, and so he was recruiting people from our law school. And so I was fortunate enough, along with some of my classmates, to be among the early people hired into the Civil Rights Division.
Mm-hmm. Were you appalled by what you saw?
Absolutely. I personally observed. The first thing that I did, actually, as a lawyer, was I spent a month with my head in a microfilm machine reading voter applications. And immediately it became clear that the slightest little error on an application from an African American was going to disqualify him or her. And I'm talking about people who are school teachers, people with master's degrees, as well as people who were farmers or workers or home housekeepers, whatever. Just didn't matter who you were, you're going to have a hard time registering to vote. And then I would read applications where the person was registered, even though he or she couldn't even sign his own name. So that was the first thing that appalled me. And then I'll never forget, on my very first trip to Alabama, I checked into a Holiday Inn in Tuscaloosa, and that evening, and we had to call in, and this was before there were cell phones, we had to call into our office every day to let them know what was happening. And that evening, the bellman, who was an African American, came up to me and said, "You know, they're listening to your phone calls."
Oh.
To death.
Oh.
So it was a surreal kind of a situation.
Yeah. We go to Chris in La Crosse next. Hi, Chris.
Hi, I'm curious, and I want to know if the guest is at all familiar with Wisconsin's new voter ID law. It's considered probably the most restrictive in the country, and I think, from my opinion and a lot of other folks who believe in the ability to vote freely, it's aimed at disenfranchising primarily minority voters, but also rural and elderly voters who have and young people who tend to vote Democratic. I'm wondering if he's familiar with it and if he has any opinions on, obviously voter IDs have been upheld by the Supreme Court, but whether this law may even go too far for that, and what his thoughts are on voter ID laws in general.
Well, I've read about the law. I don't know it in detail. The Supreme Court decision is a fairly narrow decision. Unfortunately, the people who brought it in Indiana did not put on a strong factual case about what the impact of the law was, so that they did not really show to the satisfaction of the courts that the ID law would serve as a significant barrier to voting. I think any law that does serve as a significant barrier to voting would have to overcome the provision of there's a nationwide coverage provision of the Voting Rights Act, Section 2, that says that that a law may not have the purpose or effect of abridging the right to vote based on race or national origin. And so I think that if the law in Wisconsin has that effect, then it would the Crawford case, the case from Indiana, wouldn't necessarily apply. The court would have to take a look at whatever facts are offered by the lawyers in the case. And I'm hoping that any future challenges simply have to present a much stronger factual case than was presented in Indiana.
So in Wisconsin, this law is to go into full effect next year. You'd have to see how it played out and gather information and statistics before it was challenged.
Well, there's two possibilities. Certainly, the problem, of course, with that is that then you've had one election go by where people have been had this law applied to them. But certainly, that would be the most concrete test of the facts. The other possibility would be to if you could show people who ahead of time, before the election, if you could show that people were having difficulty getting voter IDs, that this burden was falling disproportionately on African Americans, then possibly there'd be a way of enjoining the law before the election.
Mm-hmm.
That just depends on what it's possible to prove. That law does require proof of a racial impact, and so if the impact falls on a lot of people, but it doesn't fall more heavily on blacks than on whites, then the issue would be more a constitutional issue, be a tougher case.
The chair of the Democratic Party of Wisconsin, Mike Tate, said without any real need for the legislation, Republicans knew that it would impact most the elderly, students, shut-ins, African Americans, Latinos, and other groups that tend to vote Democratic. Do you think he was saying, we'll have him on the show at some point, but is he speaking from hard, fast statistics of the impact it's had on other states, do you think, or was he out of line in saying that?
Well, you know, I think it's those statements make some sense. Certainly, with respect to the elderly, it's harder for them. They're less mobile. They're less likely to have up to date records to get a voter ID. I know my mother is 96 years old. She doesn't drive anymore, so she doesn't have a valid driver's license any longer. It would be a big burden for her to have
sure
to go get an ID card. So I can, especially with the elderly or the disabled, one can see the impact pretty clearly.
I know that one of the questions that has concerned you for years and years, and very much in your work in civil rights cases, is how do we guarantee racial fairness in voting? How do you feel about it now? Do you think that we can pretty much guarantee racial fairness now, or do you still worry about it?
I still worry about it. I do think that we're facing a problem with the Voting Rights Act, which is that there are two types of provisions in it. One type is the Section 2, which applies nationwide, and that I don't think is in any danger. The other are the provisions that apply only in certain parts of the country, and those were selected by a formula having to do with how many people voted in the presidential elections in 1960, 64, 68, 72, and those provisions are based on the need to protect against the risk of discrimination, of future discrimination, what we sometimes call prophylactic legislation. And so the court seems, the Supreme Court seems less and less convinced that the risk is as great as it used to be. Certainly, when the Supreme Court upheld the Voting Rights Act in 1965 in a case called South Carolina v. Katzenbach, it specifically said one of the reasons we're upholding this law, which is very intrusive on the states, is because it's temporary legislation. So the court was anticipating that at some point the legislation would no longer, would sunset. And so there have been repeated efforts to say, well, the law should no longer be in effect because the conditions that gave rise to it no longer exist. I think that the risk is still pretty great, especially in those states. There's a big risk of backsliding. We saw that once already after Reconstruction. So after Reconstruction, as I said, in the 1870s, 1880s, African-Americans had the vote. There were African-American representatives in Congress from the Deep South. And then the troops were withdrawn, Reconstruction ended, and the Ku Klux Klan and the white establishment made it impossible for blacks to vote any longer. There were 100,000 black men registered to vote in 1900. Then the Alabama Constitution was changed, and after that change, there were something like 3,000.
Oh, my.
So I think that the risk is still there. The law has made an enormous change in the South, but that there are still forces in the South who would like to see a return to the good old days.
Mm. More phone calls in just one moment. Our number is 800-486-8655. Our guest is Professor Brian Landsberg, distinguished professor and scholar at Pacific McGeorge School of Law. We're looking at the Voting Rights Act of 1965. A lot of interest in knowing the history of voting because we've been having debate in this state, and we now have a voter ID bill. Next week, we will be looking more thoroughly at that bill, although it comes up in today's discussion, which is understandable. More of your phone calls in a moment. I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Let's go to an email. Could you please comment on legislation that has passed recently in the southern states, including Florida, restricting early voting? The legislation seems targeted to reduce the participation of certain groups that supported the Democratic Party in large numbers in 2008. In Florida, the last Sunday before Election Day has been banned as a voting day. Traditionally, African Americans have turned out in large numbers to vote on this day because they can do so after church services. There's no evidence of widespread voter fraud in the U.S., yet legislation has been passed to hurriedly mandate the use of voter IDs, which will make voting more difficult for the elderly and the poor. A couple issues there.
Well, those sorts of laws would have to, if they're passed in what is called covered jurisdictions in the South, would have to be cleared by the Department of Justice or a district court in the District of Columbia. The state would have to prove that the law doesn't have the purpose and will not have the effect of abridging the right to vote based on race, which is so. That's one of the things that the Voting Rights Act did, was to shift the burden of proof from the people who are challenging the law to the people who are defending the law. And so I don't know the particular facts with respect to those laws, but any change in voting practices or procedures has to, in the covered jurisdictions, has to be pre-cleared by the Department of Justice or by the court.
We go to Ted, next caller. Hi, Ted.
Hi, how you doing today?
Okay, you?
Just fine. I may be wrong on this information, so you're going to kind of have to bear with me here, but I heard that one of the first African-American senators, either a state or whatever senate, was from Alabama or Mississippi, and it was like around 1900. Was that part of the reason? And I mean, they had to get voted in somehow, so wasn't, you know, am I correct on any of this, or what happened after the years after?
There were members of Congress, including senators from the Deep South, from Alabama and Mississippi, during Reconstruction. That were not 1900, but in the 1870s, the so-called redemptionist governments took over after Reconstruction ended. Reconstruction ended when the North agreed to withdraw the Union troops from the South. Those troops had been maintaining peace between the African Americans and the whites, had been protecting the African Americans from the Ku Klux Klan and other such forces. So after the withdrawal of the Union troops, then it became very difficult for African Americans to vote.
Thanks, Ted, for the call. Jean in Spring Green, hi.
Hi. I would wish him to comment. Maybe I missed it, but the difference in the seriousness of voter fraud compared to election fraud, I think Gonzalez fired 8 prosecuting attorneys, if I have their title right, because they weren't bringing in enough people who they thought would be guilty of voter fraud, and yet I think they only prosecuted maybe 5 people during the whole time of the Bush administration. So voter fraud versus election fraud, and there's a great difference in the seriousness of those two.
Yeah, there's very little proof that voters are fraudulently voting. There were certainly instances. There's the famous stories about Chicago, about people who lived in cemeteries,
right,
voting and that sort of thing. But that depends on having clean voting rolls. So the voter ID is something you have to have when you go to vote, but the fraud is, if there is fraud, is more likely to be at the registration and or in not cleaning dead people off the rolls.
Thanks, Gene, for the call. Diane in Middleton, hi.
Thank you. I'd like the professor to comment whether he thinks that just requiring a voter ID, which is, I think, ultimately going to require a birth certificate first, and these things are going to be costly and very difficult for some people to obtain, is that in itself not a poll tax?
Some people have argued that it has the effect of being a poll tax. And I think part of one of the questions is, who is going to absorb the cost? I don't know the details of the Wisconsin law, certainly if you charge for the voter ID, that would seem very much like a poll tax.
Yeah, we're going.
What you're saying is that maybe even if you didn't charge for the voter ID, there would be a charge. There's a charge if, for example, to get a duplicate of your birth certificate. Many people have lost their birth certificate somewhere along the way, and if they need to get a new one, they're going to have to pay for it. I think that certainly would be a legitimate argument to make.
Thank you.
Thank you, Diane. And we are going to do a full show on the ins and outs, all the fine print of the voter ID bill in Wisconsin next week. We'll try and do it at this time, unless we're already booked with something else, but that would be good for us to do next week. Do you, I know you're a professor, but do you have any desire to take up some of these issues that have been brought up by our listeners to the courts now, or to do a thorough study of voter ID or impediments to voting?
Well, I'm actually a member of an organization called the Lawyers Committee for Civil Rights Under Law, and we do participate in court cases when they're brought, and we have a voting section that's headquartered in Washington D.C. I'm in Sacramento, so I'm a little bit distant from it. But I've been working on this issue when it gets to the Supreme Court. So I do have interest in it.
Mm-hmm. Lifelong interest. Thank you so much, Professor Landsberg, for being with us this hour.
My pleasure, Kathleen.
Our guest this hour, Professor Brian Landsberg, distinguished professor and scholar, Pacific McGeorge School of Law. He also, and I like this about his background because he's been there, as a trial attorney, was associate counsel in the Selma, Alabama civil rights cases, worked in the U.S. Department of Justice for some 22 years. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning for producing the hour. Thanks to Chrissy Pease for on-air production here in our downtown Milwaukee studios. And thanks, everybody, for your calls. Until tomorrow, this is the Ideas Network.